Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
Of all the gin joints in all the world, she walks into mine.
A martini, shaken, not stirred.
I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
And it's time for Movies and Booze. Fionnuala Jones, Linda Coogan and Olivia Fahey. Join us once again. Good afternoon to you all.
Hello.
Linda, we're doing low alcohol wines?
Well, not like zero.
Yeah, in the studio.
Not zero. I know. I heard you were a bit upset about that. We're talking 11% and 12.5%.
Okay.
So they're not low, but yeah. They're very popular at the moment. People are looking for lower kind of ABVs rather than the 14.5-15%, but you need to kind of go to cooler regions to get that, and obviously you're going to be compromising on flavour as well. There won't be as a big robust style, so these are lighter, fruit forward, kind of easy soft drinking styles.
Yeah, and they're made that way rather than they're slightly de-alcoholised.
Yeah, no, they're not de-alcoholised. They're literally picked cool, fermented straight away, just real fresh and crisp, and just keeping the alcohol lower, sugars. So the longer the grapes are on the vine, the more sugars they have. So they're picked earlier.
Okay.
So,
all right. Okay. Well, we'll be trying those in a wee while. Mercy.
Yeah.
I just read a few comments about it that seemed less than kind.
Yeah. And in fairness, before I went into it, that was exactly what I was expecting. And like, I think people who have heard me review things here before know that I'm like a divil for like a really good bad movie. And I was like, at best, that's what this is going to be. But I actually found it kind of interesting from a, like, I love murder mystery kind of storylines. And that's actually kind of more of what this is, with just a kind of very techie AI sort of aspect to it. So if you kind of focus more on the murder mystery side of things, it's a really interesting kind of like just longer episode of CSI kind of thing. But yes, it's definitely more of a, like, it is going to be in cinemas today, but I definitely think it's probably more suited to a, you're sitting at home with a glass of wine, watching something on streaming while you're chatting with your friend.
Yeah, so you don't have to pay that much attention. Is it, because I saw some people saying career low for Chris Pratt.
I wouldn't say it's a career low, because I actually thought that he was quite good at it. And also, like, I find Rebecca Ferguson can actually be kind of robotic in a lot of her performances, which actually works in her favour in this sense, because she is playing an AI judge. So I thought that was actually quite good casting. But there are definitely some positives from it. And from a technical standpoint of the actual, like, filming process, there's a couple of really cool, like, nerdy things that I enjoyed. So there are some good fun facts in there.
Yeah, you find the good in everything.
I do.
That's your fault.
No one really goes out to make these things to be bad. So,
no,
like, if I could find a bit of good to talk about in it, like, it's not like even like Joker Folie à Deux. Like, that was the angriest I think you'd ever seen me reviewing a film before. Mm. But even then, I was like, there was some good in there. They just couldn't execute it well. Like, that's just how I am.
And the history of sound is this. Would Paul Mescal have been wishing this had come out earlier, perhaps?
Honestly, it is actually a very good performance by him. I would say better than Hamnet, for sure.
Oh, right.
But,
like, that's not saying he put in a poor performance at all.
No, exactly. It's just, I think this could have been more of the horse he should have backed in terms of his Oscar hopes, especially now that we know that he did not earn the Oscar for Hamnet after all. But it is an interesting story. I actually think the music is probably the highlight of it, which when you're talking about a film called The History of Sound, you'd really hope that the soundtrack is something that's quite the earworm. It's a lovely, beautiful story, just a little bit long in my book. So,
right.
And then it also kind of raises a few other questions as well as to, you know, who should be playing roles that are based in kind of the LGBTQI community and things like that. So, lots to talk about in terms of that film.
Well, it's his second time being cast as a gay man.
It is, yes. And like, well, we don't know where exactly he lands on the sexuality spectrum kind of thing, but he
seems to like girls. Yeah. I think that's pretty much
we've only known him to be really dating women. So it does sort of beg the question of, like, is he, as much as he does, he has performed very well in, like, All of Us Strangers and in History of Sound, you know, it does beg the question. And we don't also know, like, Josh O'Connor is his co-star in this. We don't know what his sexual preferences are. I don't think he's ever
should
really
that matter,
about it.
Isn't it?
But
just
should it
acting?
Matter? Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. So it bodes all these questions. There's lots of debate about it going on online and things like that. So, yeah.
Well, is the LGBT community wildly underrepresentative in the film industry?
Well, I think because there was such a long time where gay people just weren't getting cast in the gay roles because they weren't doing what the media kind of wanted gay people to be portrayed as. So I think Eric McCormack getting cast as Will in Will and Grace was a really famous one because even though he was up against someone who was actually gay, they went with him because they're like, but he comes across as gay more for screen. It's what people imagine a gay person to be, as opposed to you, who are is actually gay. So it's this weird kind of like.
I always thought like comes across as maybe a bit gay, but not too gay, as opposed to the gay best friend who was
Jack,
super gay.
Yeah. Exactly. Which well, I thought it was really weird, but yeah, that's apparently what they said, is that like that's why he was cast over. I feel like it was John Barrowman, but maybe don't quote me on that. But I think it was someone like who was like very, very out of the closet kind of thing.
Yeah.
Who was beaten to that role. So it does, like, there's always, and especially like Paul Mescal also did like a photo shoot around the time of Gladiator, and he was in like the leather kilt and like posing like with all its workout gear. And there was a lot of talk around that time of like queer baiting. So it's like wondering, like, are actors playing into this in order to try and get the gay community to come and see more of their things, because they're not just thirst traps for women anymore. They're also thirst traps for the guys as well. So there's a lot of talk about, you know, representation and whether, you know, things are being done right or just being exploited in the industry these days.
Yeah. But women baiting is all right, but queer baiting isn't. Is that the distinction there?
Apparently.
I don't know. I'm confused. Anyway, there were generally good results from the Oscar nominations. How did the Irish do in the Razzie nominations, Fionnuala?
I think we came out relatively unscathed. I can't say the same for anyone who appeared in Snow White, the live action, which feels like 8,000 years ago, but is up for 6 awards, the 2026 Razzies, including Worst Picture. Unsurprising, given the performances in that film. It's such a shame, because it could obviously, beloved story, could have been so good, but alas. It's six nominations, and it's tied with War of the Worlds. Did you see War of the Worlds on Prime with rapper Ice Cube talking about it's very COVID-esque, right? So he's a CIA operative, I don't know, works for one of them, I don't know, obviously aliens come, it's really bad. The whole film takes place on a computer, right, where he's having to like zoom people and try and like set off rockets to like kill the aliens, and then he's having to react to, you know, people being hurt or people dying on the screen. So it's just him going, oh, and then like backing away from the computer, being like, this is terrible, whatever. It
sounds like the cheapest film ever made.
Oh, I'd say it cost €4 in a dream, you know what I mean? Yeah. I think the budget went to get Ice Cube in the seat, and that was it. Very so bad it's good. Like, if you had 90 minutes and just kind of.
Olivia? She loves it. One of the best films I've ever seen.
No, I'm just going to say the director of that is the same as the director of Mercy.
Oh,
so we tie it all in nicely together.
I'm not going to see Mercy then, I don't think, but anyway.
Yeah.
Look, in terms of Worst Picture, as I said, Snow White, War of the Worlds, they're up against Hurry Up Tomorrow, which was The Weeknd's album film, went viral because he was so hammy acting in it. Also up against Star Trek Section 31. And speaking of Chris Pratt, The Electric State, which is also for three
I've seen
awards.
Star Trek Section 31 and The Electric State. They were both atrocious.
Yeah.
Winners.
You said something earlier about Chris Pratt career, talk about this being a Chris Pratt career low. I was like, what are the highs, Sean?
Good point. Yeah.
Parks and Rec.
Well, and he's good at running away from dinosaurs, that kind of thing.
I mean, we could all be good at running away from dinosaurs. We're given enough money and put in front of the screen.
Look scared, Chris. That's the same face.
Yeah.
Really.
We've also got Jared Leto is up for Tron Ares. Ariana DeBose is up for Worst Actress for Love Hurts. Natalie Portman is actually up for Worst Actress for Fountain of Youth. Michelle Yeoh is also for Worst Actress for Star Trek Section 31. Lots of nominees there.
Nicolas Cage.
Poor old Nicolas Cage. Yeah, Worst Supporting Actor for Gunslingers. Robert De Niro as well.
Wow.
Worst Screen Combo for Frank Invito in The Alto Knights. So we will find out who ends up taking home the 2026 Razzies on March 14th, which is the day before the Oscars.
Do any of them go?
Sometimes. I know Sandra Bullock went her year because it was the year she won. Like, she was also nominated for The Blind Side, but then was also nominated for that terrible film that I want to say is called All About Steve or something to do with Steve.
Yes.
She stars opposite Bradley Cooper. She's like a freak in it and is like obsessed with this fella and is obsessed with crosswords. I think she went to both because it's like good PR. You're seen to be a good kind of sport. Well, look, it was good PR in the sense that she was also about to win the Oscar, and that was like kind of sewn up. If you're just nominated for the Razzies, do you go? Probably not. Although
yeah,
I think
if your film
again
is utter pants, then you're just acknowledging it was utter pants, really, aren't you?
Yeah, essentially.
Yeah, okay. Right, tell us about our first wine today, Linda.
Okay, so there's a few little things that these two wines have in common. So the first one is from Mazzy. an Italian well-known brand, and this is one of their new style wines. I've actually done the red before on the show, so this is their Fresco di Masi Bianco, so the white version of it. So the bottle is a different kind of shape. Again, I've
it
shared
is, yeah,
it.
It's kind of like a whiskey bottle.
Yeah,
almost.
Isn't it? Like, yeah. So they've this is only 400 grams empty, so that's a lightweight glass bottle. So they're really trying to make lower carbon footprint, more sustainable, and just kind of appeal to a younger market. Because Masi, you probably know the Valpolicella and the Amaronis that they have. They are classic staples. Loads of people will know that, their parents, grandparents and all the rest. And this is them, like the winery is going back, aging, is it 1772, 254
wow.
years.
Wow.
So, you know, it's a long time out there. And the second one I have is actually only established in 1998. So there's old and new.
Okay.
But they're both being really innovative. So yeah, this is the white, really fresh, crisp, kind of citrus fruit, bit of floral and a bit of pineapple as well. So easy to drink, only 11% alcohol. So it's not like, you know, it's not going to live up to a big hearty stew or anything like that. It's more of a sipping, summertime, daytime drinking wine and brunch, you know, really easy. Do you like it?
Yeah, it's a breakfast wine then.
Breakfast wine. Breakfast wine. Okay. Breakfast wine. So
it's
again,
got like a buttery texture to it as well.
Yes, that's the kind of the pineapple kind of notes for me coming through. So again, on its own, simple pasta, salads. It's in a good few independents, McHugh's and O'Brien's as well.
What are the grapes in it?
So, oh yeah, good question. So there, it's a blend of grapes from the Veneto region, and it is Chardonnay, Garganya and Pinot Grigio. So a blend. So not one is sticking out too much. The Chardonnay is actually giving you the texture there as well.
Well, the Pinot Grigio wouldn't stick out because it doesn't taste or anything. So
that
wine actually tastes of something. So that's good. Right, we'll take a break. What movie would you like to do first, Olivia?
Let's do The History of Sound. Why
the
not?
The History of Sound coming up after this.
Excuse me.
No.
Quiet,
no,
please.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean that.
Now you have to sing. You shy?
Don't sing love songs. You'll wake my mother. She's sleeping here right by my side.
There you go. That's The History of Sound. Was that Paul Mescal singing there?
It is indeed, actually. And that's kind of one of the things that I really liked about it is that it actually really showcases his voice beautifully. And he kind of suits that kind of, you know, the kind of countryside of America, that kind of folky sort of songs, like really, really suits the tone of his voice. So I'm really glad that we got to play that clip now.
What period of time is this set in? Is it contemporary or
no? It's set pre-World War One, and actually the World War kicks off while the two gents are in university. So Lionel and David. Lionel is Paul Mescal's character. David is Josh O'Connor's character, and they meet in the Conservatory of Music in Boston. And it's their kind of shared love of music from kind of like different aspects of the craft. Lionel is more of the singing, and David is more of the kind of like composing and writing. And they sort of develop this bond that. Over the course of the months, they kind of develop more of a romantic relationship. But it's not really, it's kind of like hinted at. And then it's really kind of shown to the audience in a couple of scenes later, so to speak. So it's a little bit like of an unrequited love sort of story, but also about the music of the time. And David actually gets drafted into the war. And when he returns, the two of them embark on this journey across the kind of like northeast of America, where they're collecting songs from all of these different communities for a project that David says that he's working on for his new job. And that's kind of the main basis for the story.
Okay. And so it's kind of Brokeback Conservatory sort of thing.
Yes. And it's one thing that apparently the team were kind of annoyed that they're getting so many like Brokeback Mountain comparisons. But, you know, the lads are literally like in the backyards of America in a tent as well. And like, you can't help but draw certain comparisons with certain scenes. So, and also Lionel, he's actually from Kentucky and he grew up on a farm and things like that. So there's all of these other kind of like parallels to the film, but they are kind of like tonally a little bit different. Especially like so much more emphasis on like the music as opposed to their relationship, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but is the story arc about will they have a relationship? Is that like the central question to it? And the music is, or because it sounds like a bit like a road movie, perhaps.
Kind of, yeah. And even like once their kind of journey ends, you do still follow Lionel's story as to like where does his life sort of take him, and you know, David is always kind of like still in the back of his mind, but it's still like he's still working through music, he's still doing all of these different projects, but you know, has he met like new lovers throughout his years, like, but is always still thinking back on his time with David. And it's an interesting kind of parallel, because as much as the story still is like such a focal point of their bond, it's actually only like half the film that they actually sort of share together, and then the rest is separate. So it's an interesting kind of way of doing it. It's almost like a tale of two halves.
Yeah. And it's when you say unrequited, one was more into it than the other.
Not necessarily. It's kind of unclear as to who was more into it than the other, or were they both as into it as each other was. But as the story kind of unfolds, you get to figure out the answer to that question, if that makes sense. I don't want to say too much in case they spoil it, but it's a lovely little story. It really is. And the kicker for me is just that it was just that little bit too long. It's just over 2 hours. I think it's like 2 hours and 8 minutes. But even then you're like, you could have probably tightened it up to a nice tidy 90 minutes or 98 minutes or something like that. And then it would have been a lovely sort of story that you didn't feel like was dragging on towards the end, because there were at least like, and actually Chris Wasser and I were even saying this after the screening, that there was at least 5 different examples of when they could have ended the film, but then it just kept going.
So you're kind of like, right.
You're kind of like, okay, so is this when it's going to end? And like, actually the point that it does end, you're like, okay, grant, that was a nice ending. I just wish he got to that point a little bit sooner and didn't kind of fake us with all of these other near ending kind of moments as well.
Yeah. And the music in the film, are they playing full songs? Is that like a feature of the film?
They're kind of more clips. So when they're going around collecting the music, you're kind of getting more like a verse and a chorus from each of the people as they're kind of like singing into this like weird contraption from the early 1900s kind of thing. It's kind of nice to kind of hear like the different tones, the different songs. And I have absolutely no idea if they were just created for the film or if they are actually old folk songs or not. But it's a nice kind of introduction to the genre of the music of the time as well. It was just kind of nice, actually, just to hear something different.
Is it based on a true story at all?
I don't think so.
Right. OK.
I could be wrong, but as far as I'm aware, it's not.
Now, there was a chap whose name escapes me now. Alan, what's his name? Who went round? It was Alan something. He was American. He went around the States for years and collected kind of old folk songs and 12-bar blues songs and all that kind of stuff, and created a huge archive of them. A lot of that music, well, probably wouldn't have died out, but he certainly helped reactivate its kind of popularity. That sounds kind of similar.
It sounds very, very similar. And actually, even with the way that they kind of introduce Lionel as a child, one of the things that they do is that they kind of say that he could see sound, and that like he assigns like colours to all these different noises. But then it's not addressed again throughout the rest of the film. And I kind of wish it was, especially with the concept of hearing all of these different folk songs. Like, how was he interpreting them? And what was he seeing as well as hearing? I thought that would have been a really interesting concept to kind of delve into a little bit more. But it's literally not addressed again from the little introduction at the start.
That's it. Yeah. Sly Stone said the same thing. He could see, he saw songs too, which is probably a form of synesthesia makes it, you know, probably partial explanation why people were very gifted. Is it though? Is it worth going to the cinema? Should you wait till it comes out in a streamer?
I enjoyed the cinematic experience to see it, just because with the music, it does give it a bit more gravitas on the bigger screen. But yes, if you are kind of just thinking it's like, oh, maybe it's just something I'll just throw on in the background, then that's probably more suited for at home. Like, don't be taking your phone out in the middle of the cinema kind of thing. But no, I enjoyed it. It's a solid like 3.5. I was debating whether or not would I go as far as 4 stars, but I don't think so, just because I do hate a film that doesn't know how to end.
Yeah.
And that for me just kind of irked me so much that I was like, no, like that could have been a tidy 98 minutes.
Yeah.
Film.
But if you give it 3.5, that's probably 2.5 from everybody else.
Let's be honest.
Yeah. Okay, so Substack has launched a TV. Will you explain what all this means?
Yes, okay,
because it's too bloody complicated.
So Substack is an app and a website. It basically positioned itself as like a newsletter platform.
Yeah.
So like writers were going to Substack, you know, to kind of launch their own blogs, essentially, kind of moving away from mainstream media is not the right word, but you know, like the instability of traditional media, shall we say, where they would basically have their own, you know, journalism, print media, everything like that. They're moving to Substack to be able to, because you can monetize on Substack, I should say, as well. So you can have a free newsletter, you can pay, whatever. But Substack has kind of grown into this
other thing now. There's been loads of investment over the last few years. So now they have video and live streaming capabilities. They have this feature that's called Notes, which essentially it seems like it's trying to take off Twitter, kind of like you write, it's microblogging essentially. So you're writing very short things about, like, me saying something about Heated Rivalry, you know, like, I love Heated Rivalry, lol, you post that, whatever, separate to your newsletter. Basically now they're launching a TV app, so you'll be able to access Substack on Apple TV and Google TV apps. I think it's in beta testing, so I'm not sure it's rolled out to everyone yet, and subscribers will be able to watch videos and live streams from creators they follow, but there'll also be a separate feed, not entirely similar to like TikTok, you know, on the For You page, where it feeds you stuff that you might not necessarily follow but the algorithm will think you like. And I just thought it was interesting because, you know, like, there's been a divisive reaction to this, because obviously, I mean, it's kind of good in the sense that it is another way for individuals to like reach their audiences and monetize and make money through that way. But then also there's some writers who are saying this was supposed to be a writing platform, not why are we pivoting so hard to video when, I don't know, I think we've seen this film before and didn't like the ending, where there was so much money put into video. We've seen, like, MTV was a big one where they put in all this money into video journalists and then got rid of them when the quote unquote big pivot to video didn't happen. It's just like, I'm just kind of pondering like what we're going to categorise as TV in the years to come, because this also just comes off the back of Netflix announcing their big slate of video podcasts. They have their first one, which is going to be, they're taking a couple of, or they're not taking, but they're working with Netflix, or Spotify I should say, to host Spotify shows, so you'll be able to watch the podcasts on Netflix. But they've also announced this one with Pete Davidson, which is called The Pete Davidson Show, which is their first kind of original one. It's a video podcast, but it's also not technically a podcast because it's not on an RSS feed, which is how podcasts are distributed.
Yeah.
It's a glorified talk show, you know what I mean? Like, it's, yeah. And their positioning is that it's just Pete Davidson in his garage talking to presumably celebrities, whatever. There's also issues with the fact that because they're describing it as a podcast, but because it's on Netflix, I think it's non-union, which throws up a whole other issue. Mm. It's just like very interesting to see where the media landscape is going and what we're kind of categorizing as television and what we will end up kind of watching on our TV that isn't like traditional TV.
And well, so even the term podcast is becoming meaningless.
Kind of, yeah, because it's, well, would I go as far as that? I don't know. The concept of what it is has just completely, or they're trying to get it to completely change in the last few years. Like, podcasting started as an audio product.
Yeah.
And now it's become a thing where if you don't have video, and I think the research still kind of depends. I think it's like still 50-50 on, in terms of people who actually do engage with video podcast. There's very few video podcasts that I'd watch, honestly, like, because I prefer, again, for me, that's not the function. I want to listen usually while I'm doing something else. I'm not sitting down to watch a podcast. But by comparison to actual these kind of new digital media talk shows like Chicken Shop Date, I would sit down and watch that. Hot Ones, I would sit down and watch that, because that's how that functions. You're looking to see the reactions as opposed to with the podcast. I'm like, I don't care. I want to hear two people yak, you know, that kind of way. It's just, it'll be interesting to see if they kind of double down on this, because again, Substack isn't like a Patreon or something else. It has been predominantly for writers. It's been for people who want to blog about whatever, fashion, TV, everything else. They haven't necessarily been using it as a video platform, and I don't know how many people are actually seeking it out to watch it on their TVs. Yeah. You know,
but could it mean like when this happens that you could be watching something, like if it's combined with Netflix, you're watching Netflix and you can see comments about whatever you're watching on your Substack feed?
Oh, maybe. Yeah, that's actually, I think, probably where they would want to see that it's like kind of fully interactive, because that's also another ecosystem itself, like streaming. Like, there's a whole world of it here that I don't really understand. But like, you think about the American streamers who are like, you know, like their full first name celebrities like Kais and Ash and iShowSpeed. I don't really know anything about them by their names. And I know that they're huge, and the people that know about them and care about them are obsessed with them, but the people that don't. It's interesting. I'd say that's where they will inevitably end up going.
You exist in this world, and even you're struggling to keep up.
I know. there's too much going on. I just want to go to bed.
A podcast is audio for me.
But it was
5 minutes ago.
But in this era of trying to like reach people and to grow, and you're trying to share on social media, people want the video clips. Yeah. You know what I mean? But then it's also started this ecosystem where brands and stuff are faking podcasts. Like, I don't know if you've ever seen it, where you might get a sponsored ad on social media where it's two people pretending like they're talking about something, but it's actually not. It's completely it's just to promote their brand, but they're pretending that they're taking part in a podcast interview in order to sell you this idea of legitimacy.
It's bonkers. We should just unplug the whole thing, I think.
Yeah, well, and, well, at least they're real people for the time being.
But, well, you know, oh my God, small
Mark's
seats.
Time,
yeah.
That'll be the end of that. Yeah. Anyway, welcome to your 60s, because you're now confused. Alan Lomax was the name of the American song collector I was trying to think of. Thank you for the 20 million people who texted in to say that. Right, so Jacob Elordi is going to be this week's Bond.
Yes, yeah. After Bond Watch last week, in which we talked about how publicists are gaming the system to get their clients talked about no matter what, even though they might not necessarily be in the conversation at all. This actually might be a bit legit, though, I will say. So Jacob Elordi is just off the back of an Oscar nomination for Frankenstein, which is why I'm kind of a bit cynical about this, but I'm less cynical just because, you know, they've talked about wanting a younger Bond. If he does get it, if he is in the conversation at all, he would be the youngest ever Bond. Apparently he's met with director Denis Villeneuve and the Amazon bosses. I think because it's Stephen Knight as well as the screenwriter, and he loves being kind of gritty and doing kind of violent things. I feel like Jacob can do that. Jacob has played a lot of not very likable characters, isn't really afraid to get dirty. I think, again, according to these reports that are out this week, they're looking for someone that looks like they could have violent tendencies, which is a crazy descriptor.
Which is kind of Bond. Yeah.
Crazy descriptor. But you know what, Jacob, he's like 6'100" or whatever. He's so tall. I think I would like to see this. It's kind of been the most excited I've been about this conversation since it started.
Do you suspect they've already made up their mind anyway?
Okay, this is the thing. Apparently, according to these initial reports, the casting announcement will be very soon because they're looking to shoot, I think, early 2027 or like kind of So I believe the gears are moving. Whether it's Jacob or not, who knows? As I said, could be people just get, you know, because it's good. It's good press. It's good buzz for the Oscars, even though I don't think he'll win in his category. Yeah. But I digress. Wait and see. I just feel like Denis Villeneuve would actually want to work with him as well, because he's just done, like, he has good range in terms of what he's done. Like, this is a fellow who started out in The Kissing Booth on Netflix and then did Euphoria and then has done Frankenstein and did The Elvis and has done Asia. You know, like, he's not afraid. And he's obviously going to be in Wuthering Heights, which is coming out soon, which that remains to be seen. But anyway, he's interesting, I think, at least, where some of the others, I think, maybe haven't shown their full scope, or they're too action-y. They're nearly too Bond. Whereas if they want to go to, like, I think if they're looking at setting this in the 50s, 60s, I'm not a Bond aficionado, so forgive me, but was he in the Navy or something, or did he start doing that? Was he a lieutenant? Don't know. Anyway, the beginnings of his career, but kind of before he became Bond as we know Bond. That's what they're looking to get after.
Proto-Bond.
Proto-Bond, teen Bond.
Okay, well, you better get a move on. Or next thing we know, James Bond is going to be a podcast on where he chats with his foes. You are listening to the Moncrief Show and News Talk. We'll take a break back in a couple of minutes. Right, so let's move on to our red wine.
Cheers.
So this day last week, I was actually in this winery of the wine that we're having now. It's great, isn't it? So the place is, the winery is called Cramalay Rekesh, right? Cramalay Rekesh.
Okay.
The wine is called Wildflower. So that's a little bit easier.
So basically, what country is that in?
Romania.
Oh,
yeah, fancy. I know. So the place that the winery is located is Timișoara, and it's the third biggest city in Romania. I've never been to Romania before. It had been like minus 14 degrees. It was so cold and everything. Now, it was starting to thaw the snow and everything, but seeing the vineyards covered in snow was magical. It was amazing.
Yeah.
And I've done another one of their wines previously on the show that won an award as well. So I think Romania is a place to watch. You're going to get good value for your money. This particular one is called Wildflower. It's exclusive to O'Brien's, but you can buy others of their wines called Paparuda brand in independent shops. So they do Pinots, Sauvignon, Chardonnay and Cabernet Sauvignon. So there's a nice range, but they do have native grapes as well that they're kind of starting to trickle out to the export market. But this is family run. They bought the winery in 1998, so it's fairly new. But Leslie Williams, obviously on Movies and Booze, he was there 12 years ago and he came on the trip as well. And the difference was unreal. They've invested 30 million into the winery and they make... how much do they make? They make 30 million bottles export now at this stage. So they're huge. But they make wine for so many different countries, markets and everything. And there's lots on your shelves. You just have to kind of ask and look for them now. But this is a Pinot Noir. It's really, really soft, fruity, raspberry, cherry, gorgeous notes. And they, in O'Brien's, they do a whole range again, Sauvignon, Chardonnay, Pinot Grigio and a Syrah as well. So Paparuda is the one you'll find in independent wine shops, and Wildflower is the ones you will find. And Encanto is another, Encanta is another range that they do as well in the Irish market. But it's just husband and wife team and other wine winemakers that they fly over from Australia to, you know, consult and help out, you know, advising them how to make the best of the facilities that they have. But like, they're really sustainable, looking after the community. They've employed 250 people there. It's just a really great, it was really exciting trip. Yeah. We were there for 2 days.
It doesn't taste like a Pinot, and I mean that in a good way.
Mm. Why? What do you mean?
Well, Pinots can be, you know, sometimes a bit insipid.
Yeah. It's packed with fruit, isn't it? It's really juicy. Like, yeah. And it has a savoury note to it as well. Again, pâté, a little bit of duck, a nice bit of roast chicken with truffles would work with this as well.
Yeah.
You know, it's just really,
that's what
really
Olivia
nice.
Had for breakfast. That's what she mentioned.
I'm very bougie these days.
Yeah.
I just, this day last week I spent with Elvira Cox, who is the wife of Philip, and the two of them run the winery, and it's amazing. So, shout out to Romania.
Okay, that's very nice. Yeah, that's very nice indeed. Right, so Nigella Lawson for Bake Off.
Yeah, Prue Lee
says. Is that confirmed or?
Reports are suggesting, we'll leave it at that. Prue Leith has obviously announced that she's leaving the Great British Bake Off after 9 series, presumably also to join the race for James Bond, but that remains to be seen. obviously said this week that she'd loved being a part of it, and she said now was the right time to step away, because I think people either forget or don't realise that she's 86, which, fair play to her.
Yeah.
A lot of early reports suggesting that it's going to be Nigella signing the dotted line to take over. Now, I will say these kind of rumours have been abound for many years, but I think it would make sense. I think it would be a lot of fun. Nigella has judged before on a couple of the MasterChef series, so I think this would be a good transition.
Is she a baker,
for her.
Though?
Is she a baker?
She could be like, ooh, you can talk.
She might have to dial it down.
No use of the microwave. But she has the home cook vibes, isn't she? Because I'm pretty sure she's not qualified in that sense. Open to correction on that, but I'm pretty sure that was her whole appeal, that it was home cooking and stuff like that. And obviously, gloves and innuendo herself, so kind of match made in heaven, no? Remains to be seen, anyway,
we'll
see.
Yeah.
I think, yes.
Yeah. I would love to see it, but remains to be seen. Not confirmed, but heavily, heavily rumoured. So.
Yeah, no in your endo. Right, so we'll move on to our second film. It is Mercy. Here's a clip.
Mr. Raven, how do you plead?
Not guilty. I'm not guilty. I can't be. I wouldn't hurt her.
Based on available evidence, I have already judged your probability of guilt to be 97.5%. This is 17.5% above the 80% threshold to trigger a mercy trial. This is the Los Angeles Municipal Cloud. Every private citizen and organization is mandated by law to connect their devices to it.
There you go. That's Mercy. Even from that clip, there's a bang of the, what was the name of the Tom Cruise film?
Minority Report.
Yes.
And I was going into this really thinking that there was going to be a lot more comparisons to that. And while yes, it's still there, one thing that kind of separates it out is that this is kind of set more as a, you have committed the crime and now we're kind of just going to judge to see, are you so guilty that we're just going to kill you in the chair right now?
Yeah.
Whereas with Minority Report, that was done like, you are predicted to commit this crime in the future, so we're just going to arrest you now before you get to commit the crime.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the main distinguishing factor, but there are definitely some similarities aside from that. It's actually, one thing I really liked about the film is that it's done in, so it's an hour and 40 minutes long, but the trial itself is 90 minutes, and it's actually done in real time. So it's completely like it's done to the T that, you know, as he's trying to find all of this evidence to prove that he's actually innocent, it is in the real time of his trial sort of thing. So it's a nice kind of way to tie it all in, that you are literally living every single moment of this with him. And I think it's a great way to engage the audience.
And what's he been accused of doing or found guilty of, I suppose?
So with this Mercy AI judge, so Judge Maddox, played by Rebecca Ferguson, they've introduced this to basically help them take crime off the streets. And they've had 8 people go into this chair, and all 8 of them have been found guilty and just like electrocuted in the chair immediately. And Chris Pratt's character is actually the guy who's been championing it and had been arresting all the people and putting them into the chair. And now he has been accused of murdering his wife and he is the one in the chair. And as you heard in the clip, his probability of whether or not he's actually guilty is like 17% over the threshold that would warrant a mercy trial. So that's kind of where the premise that we're introduced to it in. And the way that it's filmed, because of course it's all very like digital, all very AI, a lot of screens. So like there's moments where he's calling people and like their phone pops up on the screen and it's literally just them like, holding a phone, like the way that people do like video calls walking down the street these days.
Oh, they're God, this is a podcast doing... as well.
Yeah, pretty much. And like that's kind of how like they're shown in the scene. And I've been trying to find out because it doesn't look like it's been done green screen per se, but it actually looks like they've used like I know people have heard it, like they've used it for like the Mandalorian with Lucasfilm, the volume. So it's basically a surround screen that you can just put stuff onto the screen. Like you can even like be driving a car down a road and it looks exactly like you're driving a car down the road, but you're actually just sitting like static as it's moving around you kind of thing. Almost like the old school way they used to do it, but much more high tech. And that's what this looks like. It actually looks like it's completely surrounding him at times. And even if it gets a little bit wiggy with the CGI in little bits, it actually works in the context of the way that they're kind of like transforming the scene around him as well. So
okay.
For me, from a, like a technical standpoint, I was like, that's really cool if they have like just filmed this entirely in the volume in Sony Studios.
Yeah.
I forget what group that they're called, but it's a really, really cool sort of setup that they have there. And I kind of hope that that's the way that they did it.
So does Chris Pratt spend the entire film just sitting in this chair?
Yeah.
Does he get to stand up? No?
No.
No?
I can't.
Toilet break?
I can't. No, because like he's literally just like sat in the chair just trying to find enough evidence to prove one way or the other if he's guilty or innocent of killing his wife. There's video of him like knocking on the door and breaking the Ring doorbell camera. And oh yeah, that's another thing that they say in the clip as well, is that like everybody's phones and digital things, they're all uploaded to this cloud and they are like they're able to like hack into information. And even like the neighbor's bird camera for the bird feeder, like they're able to like hack into that to try and see like had anybody like gotten into his house through the back door instead of the front door and things like that. So
okay, so he's just sitting in the chair, they're presenting this evidence and he's just like ringing a few random friends to see can they help him.
Yep. Pretty much.
Doesn't sound like much, really, does it? I must say.
It does sound like another like low budget thing. And as I said as well, like it is directed by the guy who did the Ice Cube War of the World. His name, I'm going to butcher this, Timur Bekmambetov. He also did the Ben-Hur remake in 2016. So like, you know,
we all remember that.
The line is very low in terms of expectations. But this one, like, I thought it was a bit better than a good bad movie. Like it had like some really interesting kind of concepts. And if you do like that kind of murder mystery thing, this actually was quite interesting the way that they did it. I liked it.
Is Chris Pratt stuck for work?
Who knows? Because every time he gets cast on something, everyone's kind of annoyed about it, especially when it was like Mario. I think the second Mario movie is coming out this year and people are still kind of annoyed that he's still voicing the character. Yeah. But, you know, I think he kind of suffers from a bit of like overexposure for sure. And then also like some of his personal beliefs as well has irked people quite a bit. So
what are they? Sorry.
He's very much into God, and the church that he was that he would go and worship in was one of the most notorious like anti-LGBTQ groups.
Oh, right. Okay.
And yeah, so he wasn't able to kind of like separate himself from that per se.
Oh, right. Okay. So there was absolutely no way he was ever going to get cast in Paul Mescal's film today. No. No
queer baiting.
Right. Okay. Right. So He-Man in The Masters of the Universe, about which we're all very excited. There's the barrel. Let's go underneath it.
I don't know. Some people love the original this. No, some people love
actually,
He-Man.
On that, this is queer baiting. Yeah. This is totally queer baiting. Even the cartoon was queer baiting.
It's absolutely crazy. And Nicholas Galitzine, who is playing He-Man, the titular He-Man, the way he is bulked up for this is insane. He looks like he's eaten a person. It's crazy. He looks incredible, but like he's really, really bulked up for this. This is coming from Amazon and Mattel Studios. Obviously, this is coming June 5th, 2026 in the US. And I think an international release is due for later that month as well across the world. The way they're kind of positioning it is Nicholas Galitzine is He-Man. He's wasting away in corporate America. Someone finds his sword. He has to go back to Eternia and sort Skeletor out with all his mates. What a laugh. Very, can't wait.
Very relatable story. That's our lot for today. Thanks to Fionnuala, Linda and Olivia.
Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
Of all the gin joints in all the world, she walks into mine.
A martini, shaken, not stirred.
I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.